This is A Burden to Be Well, Sisters and Brothers of the Mentally Ill, a radio documentary. The devastating effects of mental illness have been well documented in films, books, and academia. But until recently, there's been little said about the sisters and brothers of the mentally ill. If, as many experts agree, one out of five Americans has a serious mental illness, that's 40 million people, which means their siblings must number at least twice that many. A body of research on what's called a well sibling syndrome is starting to emerge, along with a growing number of personal memoirs. Coming up, WFCR's Karen Brown brings us two intimate sibling portraits. But first, she talks to a range of siblings and experts on the ways mental illness affects its closest bystanders.
I often feel like this sort of genetic bullet was fired and it nicked me and it hit Debbie right in between the eyes, you know?
I have, at times, resented my brother for taking up so much time and room and space and terrorizing and anguishing my parents so much, yeah.
At one point, my parents gave me a hook and eye lock for my door. And this is the period where my sister was killing my pets. And when I finally confronted my mother about this, she said, well, you know, what could we do? She was our daughter also.
My mom used to say when I was in the 20s, Larry, you're at the bottom of my worry list. And I'd say, I don't like that because I have my own worries. I have my own concerns. But, you know, my family needed someone like me. You know, like you can't have everybody going crazy.
In recent years, siblings have started to speak out about the trauma, the guilt, and the hidden resentment of growing up with brothers or sisters with severe mental illness, conditions like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or major depression. Many well siblings felt ignored, while their ill sibling swallowed the family's energy and attention. No one seemed to notice what the illness was doing to the so-called healthy one.
We both had pet hamsters, and I remember one of her games was holding her hand up and letting the hamsters run up and down the keyboard of the piano, and having her slam down the lid of the keyboard and kill my hamster. But that was, to me, it was like, yeah, don't complain when your pet gets killed because you could be next.
That's Clea Simon, a Boston journalist who wrote the memoir Madhouse, Growing Up with a Mentally Ill Brother and Sister. Both of her older siblings were struck with schizophrenia when Clea was only six. Simon's sister, at 16, became violent and threatening until she was sent to a group home. Her brother transformed from a beloved nurturer to a paranoid loner who eventually committed suicide.
You know, when you see your brother and your sister grow up and change from your brother and your sister into something scary and weird and alien, you just think that's what happens. You think that when you hit 16, you're allowed to date and to drive, and then you're hospitalized.
It's almost like my brother kind of died when he was 22, but he lived as a ghost for the next 45 years.
Larry Roof of Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, was in high school when his older brother Jack descended into schizophrenia.
We'd have to visit him every Sunday. My mom would make us visit him, and we'd have to go into this terrible Edgar Allan Poe type state hospital that smelled and listened to my brother rant and rave and beg us to take him home.
Roof and Simon, both separately, believe they now suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, a collection of debilitating symptoms, from flashbacks to nightmares, usually seen in people who've been in combat, attacked, or who've witnessed something terrible.
A family will go from one crisis to another, and there is very little time or effort to explain to siblings what's going on, and so that makes it more likely that there would be these PTSD symptoms that persist decades later.
University of Pittsburgh psychologist Diane Marsh wrote the book Troubled Journey about families and mental illness. Marsh conducted one of the first studies of well siblings of the mentally ill.
I kept noticing that they were talking about what we might call emotional numbing, that they had at some level and sometimes fully lost the capacity to feel.
Or, as Rex Dickens, Marsh's co-author and himself the brother of three mentally ill siblings, puts it, siblings like him are frozen souls.
You kind of shut down emotionally in part of your life, and then that kind of carries over into, you know, other areas. You can't trust, you can't feel, you can't talk. So there's a little core there that's frozen in time and maybe to be dealt with later, but kind of never does get dealt with.
Marsh and Dickens found that well siblings have higher rates of depression than the general public and may feel it's up to them to make up for their family's loss.
They are the perfectly behaved children, the A students, because their family was fragile and couldn't afford any other problems. And so they felt, as one sibling put it, a burden to be well.
When you have to grow up early, you know, when you pick a fruit too green, it doesn't have a chance to really mature and ripen. They get kind of stopped in their development.
Others worry they might catch what their brother or sister has. Psychologist Jeannie Safer wrote the book The Normal One. Her own brother was severely depressed, erratic, and obese. And even though she became a well-known writer and accomplished therapist, she's never felt immune from her brother's fate.
If I wasn't so brilliant one day, or if I didn't have a friend, or if I, God forbid, I gained some weight, it became devastating because I could always turn into him. So he was the side of me that was dark and terrifying.
Certainly all families are different, but a collection of common symptoms is now portrayed in research literature as a sibling syndrome. One of the cornerstones is survivor's guilt. Why was my sister or brother afflicted? Why not me?
That somehow, through a stroke of fate, they had been saved from this horrible fate.
Psychologist Diane Marsh.
And as they mature and they go on to careers and relationships and families, over and over again we heard that it is with a sense of loss for their sibling who may not be able to move on.
As siblings age, there are practical concerns beyond the existential ones. In one clinical survey, 94% of well siblings reported a pervasive worry that they will have to take responsibility for a mentally ill brother or sister when their parents no longer can. Peter Roof cared for his brother Jack for more than 20 years.
So once a week, I'd take him to this diner, and I would feed him, and he'd be like a wild animal. Like, I would use my own money, I'd say, anything you want, eat and eat. And he would eat like meatloaf dinner, mashed potatoes. He had no teeth. They were all rotted and his hair was, you know, whatever. And he'd be smoking. And he never once ever said thank you, nothing.
There are family support groups geared to parents of mentally ill children, but very few designed for siblings. Psychologist Jeannie Safer, while doing research for her book, tried in vain to find clinical information on sibling issues.
I went to the index, the 404-page index of Freud's complete works. There are no references to siblings. However, there is a reference to Siberia, and my fantasy has always been, is that's where all the siblings went.
But the good news, she says, is that more siblings are finding each other, creating their own community and seeking help. Clea Simon says after years of therapy, she was finally able to confront and make peace with her past.
I think it takes a lot of strength to face something awful and not, you know, try to be a Pollyanna about it and say, oh, wasn't that bad? And I feel a certain sympathy and I really understand my sister now. I think that's crap. I think it's awful and it changes your life and it changes who you are. And if you can accept that, then you live your life now.
Siblings fare when exposed to serious mental illness depends greatly on when the illness surfaces, as Diane Marsh of the University of Pittsburgh found in her 1997 sibling study.
The younger they were, and it was a strong finding, the more vulnerable they were and the more devastating the legacy that they carried on.
In families where mental illness hits early, the entire household feels the impact. Parents coping with one wild and unpredictable child have the added challenge of raising other children who are in the middle of their own development.
Liv, we're not having any more soup. Eat it or don't have any.
I didn't. Eat what you have.
And now you can pick that up too.
No!
This, I'm told, is a relatively calm afternoon at the Stannis household in southern New Hampshire. 8-year-old Olivia is bounding between the kitchen, where she's demanding a snack from her mother, Deb, and the living room, where her two sisters are doing homework and playing computer games. Suddenly, Olivia accuses her 11-year-old sister, Audrey, of taking her toy, and her mother tells Audrey to go to her room.
You know how much of a baby she's being?
You know what you
she slapped Rose a minute ago. She slapped me a minute ago.
You know what, Audrey?
She just set her up twice.
You know what? You know better than to do that. And you need to go...
Olivia sets the tone in the house when she's having a bad day. We're all having a bad day. It's next to impossible not to feed off that irritability, that anxiety, that frustration, that anger.
2 years ago, at the age of 7, Olivia was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, an illness characterized by debilitating highs and lows and outbursts of violence. Her mother says it's been torture for her older sister, Audrey.
I mean, Audrey would be jumping on the trampoline this spring with her, and all of a sudden Audrey comes in through her jeans. She has a big bite mark. Or we'd be in the car, and she'd just be screaming, I'm just so mad, I need to bite something. She'd lean over and try and bite her sister.
It traumatizes the family, and it ends up traumatizing each individual.
Author and advocate Rex Dickens, who, like Audrey, watched his ill siblings become out of control. He considers himself and other well siblings secondary victims of mental illness.
Somebody that has to live with trauma day in and day out. And the odd deal is there's nobody to blame.
Hi, Audrey. Come on in.
On this afternoon, Audrey Stanis has just gotten off the school bus. She makes herself ramen noodles and relishes having her mother all to herself. It's a half hour before Olivia gets home. As Audrey eats, she recalls the time Olivia's outburst sent her to the emergency room.
She started calling me a name. And then next thing I know, she's saying, I'm going to throw this book at you. And I turned around right when she was throwing it, so it hit my face. And I was bleeding, and I remember screaming down the hall and watching the blood drip from my face. I don't believe she ever got grounded for that.
Her mother is well aware of the resentment Audrey feels, that her childhood is in many ways at the mercy of Olivia's volatility. For a short time, they took Audrey to a counselor.
She would just go in there. She was just so angry. She was threatening suicide. She was, I'm going to run away. I hate this family. I can't live here. And to be quite honest, what she went through, part of it, I can't blame her. She really got abused by this child, and I couldn't separate them. I felt so helpless. I couldn't protect her.
She says she does try to keep Audrey safe from Olivia. She puts them on opposite ends of the house, but as soon as she turns her back, Olivia runs to find her sister. Deb installed a lock on the door to Audrey's room, but Olivia found the key.
I should have her locked in the laundry room again. That worked.
Her mother is actually relieved that Audrey can be so blunt, like a typical child, because she worries Audrey's growing up too fast. Often after a disastrous day with Olivia, she's likely to turn to her eldest daughter for backup.
And she would be able to take her sister and turn her around and get her calmed down and do something to diffuse the situation. And I thank God for her so many times that she would do that for me. And I felt so guilty because here's my 9-year-old daughter having to be in this role of, you know, to help her sister and help me. And
it's hard on you in later life because you have not had a childhood. You've been your mother's keeper and your sister's keeper.
Jeannie Safer, psychotherapist and author of the book, The Normal One.
It is virtually universal for role reversals to occur, that the higher functioning child becomes a parent. She becomes what one person called the family vice president. No, so she has a lot of responsibility and no power.
Olivia is more stable now since her psychiatrist changed her medication, and that's made it easier for Deb and her husband to give Audrey days when she's the center of attention. Recently, Audrey competed in a cheerleading tournament where she was selected with a friend to sing the national anthem. The whole family watched, even Olivia, as she sang before a packed auditorium. But her mother wonders if special occasions like this are enough to insulate Audrey from the stress of their household. Diane Marsh says that's a valid fear.
As hard as parents may try, and they do, to meet the needs of their well siblings, time and energy are simply finite. And so siblings often feel like the forgotten family members. Everybody else's problems are more important than theirs.
11-year-old Audrey.
When Olivia is being a jerk and doing her weird thing, but like And then I'll be downstairs asking for a question on my homework, and they'll say, Audrey, go away now. They won't give me anything until they're done with her, which takes until like midnight to calm her down.
And her mother, Deb Stanis.
It would be so intense with Olivia. By the time I finally got her to bed, and Audrey would say, please, Mommy, just come with me. Come lay down with me. And by then, my whole body was just, I can't have anybody touch me. I just need to be quiet without any, you know. And so there were days where I'd say, I can't, Audrey. I just can't even come in there. I just have to go in my own bed and be alone. It breaks my heart that I even said that to her, because she deserves so much more, you know.
The sibling syndrome is not unique to childhood. Like mental illness, it often endures and evolves over the lifespan of siblings. Pam and Carolyn Spiro know this well. They're twin sisters, relaxing in Pam's high-rise apartment near Hartford, Connecticut.
For some reason, this leg is pins and needles.
Oh, do you want slippers?
No.
At 52, both are blonde and petite, with long, narrow faces. But one of them looks more weathered, less groomed, with skin strangely scarred. You might still not know who's diagnosed with severe mental illness until Pam starts to talk about her breakfast conversation.
The teacup was saying to me, there's a chip in me and it really hurts when you drink tea out of me on that side.
It never occurred to you and that maybe this, the tea had an opinion too?
Well, it might have, but the cup.
Carolyn is humoring her sister. She knows a talking teacup is an auditory hallucination, a reminder of Pam's ongoing struggle with schizophrenia. It's only the latest character in Pam's long history of mental illness, a history that sadly marred her life as well as her twin sister's. You could say it started as early as their birth, when, according to some scientists, the seed of schizophrenia was likely planted in Pam, but not in Carolyn.
Genes play some role in virtually every important chronic disease that the human is subject to. But rather than causing these, they're rather predisposing.
Psychiatrist Fuller Torrey of the Stanley Medical Institute in D.C. is heading a national study to determine why one twin gets major mental illness and the other doesn't. He now believes it comes down to an infectious agent or a virus, although they haven't yet identified which kind. In some cases, Torrey says, a pregnant mother contracts a virus or infection, but only passes it on to one child.
If you think of a virus coming and has to turn right or turn left and it goes one way or the other. The other possibility, which I think is a larger possibility, is that the majority of cases probably become infected in childhood after the child is born, in which case one of the children is infected, one of the twins in this case is exposed to the infectious agent, and the other one was not.
When Pam and Carolyn were children, they both seemed fine. Like many twins, they were best friends and bitter rivals. They even competed for thinness, to the point that both were treated for anorexia nervosa. But no one in the family, not their other two siblings, nor their parents, noticed when Pam first began to hear voices. It was November 22, 1963.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
While sitting in a grade school classroom, while everyone else was riveted by the news of JFK's assassination, Pam began to hear murmuring in her head.
Well, at first they weren't saying anything. Then they were just saying my name. And they were mangling it, you know, saying Pam, Spam, Pam, Pyro, Spyro. And then they started saying, kill you, kill, kill, will you kill him, kill you, will you kill him, will you kill you. The message was more a realization that I'd killed Kennedy.
That became her new reality, a belief she had the power to kill through her own thoughts. Pam told no one of the menacing voices now filling her head, but Carolyn could tell something changed.
She was going to school with greasy hair, greasy face, and looking disheveled and embarrassing me.
There's a lot going on in the back seat of the car that parents don't really know about.
Hella Thoring of New York State Psychiatric Institute.
The well sibling who have a sibling that's becoming ill are often the first people to kind of notice that there's something going on. And they might also be exposed to strange and bizarre behavior that they don't really know how to understand.
Carolyn and Pam Spiro stuck together after high school. They both went to Brown University, where Carolyn thrived, but Pam fell deeper into paranoia and hallucinations.
I would see her sometimes in the cafeteria, sitting alone in a corner. I'd occasionally stop by her room and find her sort of barricaded in the corner with her desk or behind the door.
She knew I was burning myself with like 10 cigarettes in a wad at a time. So I would just say things like, I feel numb, I feel like moon rock. But what I wouldn't say is that there were also voices saying, you'll feel better if you burn yourself.
And then Pam tried to kill herself with an overdose of sleeping pills. She left college and moved back home. That's when Carolyn started to pull away.
It was some sense of apprehension about being around her for fear that I'd lose the sense of separateness. Like, for years I did have this feeling that if Pammy got better, what then? Will I either have to relinquish who I am? Will I lose who I am?
When you have a brother or sister who doesn't function, you are far too merged with their identity, whether consciously, because you think you're much too similar, more similar than you really are, or unconsciously.
Psychologist and author Jeannie Safer.
Whether it takes the form of saying, well, I have nothing to do with that person, I'm the opposite of that person, or if you say, well, you know, I'm a little schizophrenic myself, it's like you're never totally separate.
As much as Carolyn tried to lead her own life, she made choices very much connected to Pam's fate. She became a psychiatrist, and she married young, something she now thinks was her way of proving she was normal. During these years, Pam had lucid stretches where she honed her writing skills and won awards for poetry. But the voices always came back, and Carolyn got frequent calls from emergency rooms where Pam ended up.
I was at my wit's end. She was becoming desperately suicidal. They were treating her like she had a terminal illness. You know, you might want to consider saying goodbye.
Pam did survive after dozens of episodes over 3 decades, some near fatal. Only recently did she find a medication that's kept the voices at bay. Pam and Carolyn have now told their story in a new memoir called Divided Minds, Twin Sisters and Their Journey Through Schizophrenia. In recent months, they've been on a book tour where they trade off reading passages at colleges and bookstores.
Would you mind turning off the radio? I asked the taxi driver. It's hurting my ears. Head turned toward me. Then, lady, you must be hearing things because the radio ain't on.
The book wasn't easy to pull off, as Pam was hospitalized several times during the writing process. And the tour has been a strain, since Pam gets tired easily and doesn't like crowds. It's also forced the sisters to spend more time together than they have in years, for better or worse. Pam's paranoia is never entirely gone. Even in the middle of the tour, she's still hallucinating about something she calls the hazmat man. That's a figure Pam sees when she looks at the hazardous materials emblem on her plastic medical baggies. Carolyn tries to empathize.
I think I see what you're talking about. Yeah, the eyebrows and that.
No. The head is up here. Oh. The arms are down over here.
Okay, no, I don't. Is it threatening man, or is it just...
Well, it's not threatening now, because I know where the real hazmat man is.
He's locked up in an Altoid box.
This is where Carolyn's face goes from bemused to exasperated.
You don't really believe that, do you? I mean, I have the box, and it's still taped up. And
keep it taped up.
I do, but you don't really believe this, do you? I mean, in all honesty...
There are times that it feels like a lot when I'm getting behind on my own bills, when she's getting sick, when she's deciding on her own not to take medication, which she's not doing at the moment, but then I feel it. Oh, yeah. Then it's an imposition. Then I hate it. Yeah, you've got the freedom to not take medication because you're independent. You get to do what you want
when you want to do it, and the hell with whatever I want. And guess whose freedom you get to take away? Mine.
These days, Carolyn has a new worry about her twin sister.
You have anything to eat?
I have pomegranate juice.
Oh, well, that's a lot.
Pam's been losing weight rapidly. She's under 90 pounds. Her jeans barely hang on her hips. And given her history with anorexia, the doctors are concerned. During this visit, Carolyn gets peanut butter out of her fridge and begs Pam to eat.
You need to eat to maintain your weight so that you can at least have clothes that hang on your body that don't fall off. And so that you don't get a cardiac arrhythmia. And so
I have a heart attack.
I've already told you this a million times.
Pam starts to tremble at her sister's scolding and walks out of the kitchen, but then she comes back and lets Carolyn finish.
That it's no different than you not taking your antipsychotic medication for me. I can't stop you. All I can do is sit and watch and feel helplessness, despair. I mean, I have no control over you. I have no control over this. So once again, my future with you is linked to something I have no control over.
The subsequent silence lasts for half an hour until they leave for a doctor's visit for Pam, one of many that was scheduled by Carolyn. And even though they live an hour apart, Carolyn often does Pam's grocery shopping and cleans her apartment. Nevertheless, they both consider this a relatively smooth patch for Pam, now that she's found an effective medication for her schizophrenia. That's helped Pam recognize her impact on other people.
I made a vow when I got out of the hospital in February that I would take every single pill, liquid, potion, whatever they wanted me to take, without fail. And I've pretty much lived up to that.
But as Carolyn is keenly aware, she could hit another bad patch. And yet, as much as schizophrenia has hurt their lives and their relationship, Carolyn says she can't imagine a world without the twin sister she loves, a sister who's sensitive and smart, but who clearly drew the short straw.
I'm so lucky. When I said earlier that I don't deserve anything that I have, all I meant was none of us deserve anything, really. We just get it by grace of whatever. I guess I think I could just as well have been the one who got schizophrenia.
Well, that's the fear of all siblings, is that there for the grace of God go they.
Author and sibling Rex Dickens.
I always believed that it was in the genes, in the blood, and that if you got it, you had it, and if you didn't have it, you didn't have it, and that I just felt they were unlucky and that it was a tragedy that they were unlucky.
I think the legacy is that you have to struggle to come into your own, that you have to struggle to feel that you have a right to your life.
Psychologist Jeannie Safer.
That you absolutely must understand and work to understand the effect of having that sibling on you. And your goal should be to make recognizing your relationship with that sibling important and essential, but not the center of your life.
A Burden to Be Well, Sisters and Brothers of the Mentally Ill, was written and produced by WFCR's Karen Brown. It was edited by Mary Beth Kirshner from American Radio Works, with additional help from John Dankowski. Reporting was supported by a Rosalind Cardo Fellowship in Mental Health Journalism and by a grant from Jean Beard. To find out more, go to our website, wfcr.org.